Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Welcome to this podcast number 734. Hey, Matt Myra, what are you doing here on an intro?
Oh, I got nothing to do right now, Chris, so I figured I'd stop by the podcast, see if you guys are recording.
He's actually been living here.
We're recording.
And then it's weird, he leaves when you come in to record and says, tell him I was never here.
through the vent.
That's so crazy.
Yeah.
Thanks for letting us come into your living room.
You're welcome. I'd like you to get rid of these tiny bottles of water every time I come in here, and they're just sitting there.
I know, man, but they just, you know, my experience is that they just disappear on their own.
I try to keep a place clean, and you assholes come in here and ruin it.
I assumed you'd sell them for the redemption value.
It's not a bad idea. Forget I said anything about bottles.
Do you guys have anything in the Nerds Community Corkboard? Matt Myra, is there anything you want to promote that you got coming up?
Nope.
Okay. You got other podcasts and stuff.
Yep.
Okay. And they're secret. I got one from inside the Nerdist family. Adam Murray has an Indiegogo campaign going right now for a short he's working on called Joe and the Pirates.
Mm-hmm.
That is this kind of Amblin-esque thing. I read the script. It's real good. And Jonah Ray's going to be in it.
Who's that?
Huh? Oh, he's a comedian from Los Angeles.
No, I'm not familiar with the city.
Really ring a bell. I mean, there's a lot of comics in Los Angeles.
Yeah, there's a lot of people.
He runs a show at a comic book store.
Oh, Kumail.
That's what I'm thinking of.
Great.
And that's what he gets for being a good guy.
I know.
Poor guy. He's such a nice guy and doesn't deserve it.
But I've read Adam's script. It's really cool. It's kind of a old school Steven Spielberg kind of throwback thing about a girl who on Halloween night runs away from some bullies and ends up hooking up with some space pirates.
Oh, that's fantastic.
That goes from September 7th to October 17th, and you can donate on Kickstarter. And he is really putting himself on the line with a bunch of the stuff he's been doing. So I'm really proud of him for getting this thing going.
Great. Good job.
So search for Adam Murray or Joe and the Pirates.
Katie!
Oh, and Indiegogo, not Kickstarter. Let me fuck up that entire promo. Indiegogo, Joe and the Pirates.
Katie. I have one that I think Matt would like, because it has to do with guitars.
You'd be surprised. Go ahead.
You are on it today.
Just staring blankly at the wall.
You're casually morphing.
I was literally staring into nothing. Yes.
You're getting married in a few weeks.
How the Grinch got married.
That would be a great story.
Yeah, my heart would grow three more sizes and I'd die.
That's a part they don't tell you about.
You ever try
the Grinch had heart disease. They're celebrating heart disease. Katie?
Anyways, if you live in the Cleveland area and you need a guitar fixed or you just want to talk to someone that knows a lot about guitars, check out Guitar Geek Shop. Stan, who runs the shop, literally knows everything about guitars.
Everything.
Everything. Dude, he can fix shit. He can build shit. It's cool.
Can he make stuff left-handed?
Probably. Guitar Geek Shop.
Yeah, Guitar Geek Shop. And if you go to facebook.com/Guitar Geek Shop, you can find out more about it.
Suddenly someone's more interested.
Let me go to this Facebook website.
All right.
Let's figure out what's going on.
And if you guys ever want to hear Matt talk for like almost 2 hours about left-handed guitar playing exclusively, listen to that episode of This Is Rad. Yeah. It's real intense.
Check it out. I've been there. I've done that podcast.
What are you finding on the website?
I'm going to find it.
This episode of the podcast is Brian Regan, who's just such a legend. He's a living legend. And by legend, I don't mean that his time is over. He is still a living, active legend. He's an active comedy legend, and you should see him live. If you have any interest in comedy, you should absolutely see Brian Regan.
And you can get a free taste of him live because he's doing that live special on Comedy Central.
I mean, the guy is such a – he is a universally loved, like, I've seen so many different types of comics who consider him an inspiration, me included. He is such an amazing comedy entity. He is promoting his Comedy Central special on Saturday, September 26th at 9 p.m., and he's filming the special live at Radio City Music Hall. So watch that when it happens. Brian Regan.
See if he says the F word on stage finally.
He's not
just live in front of millions of people.
We got him to say it on comedy and everything else. Did you guys get him to say it?
Oh, we did, yeah.
It was great.
We got him to do it on here,
treat.
Too. Yeah, it was a
treat for Brian Regan.
It's a rare gift.
Here's the Nerds Podcast number 734 with Brian Regan.
Play the thing. That's the worst Brian Regan impression.
Oh, was that Brian Regan's impersonation?
No. Oh. It was just my dumb voice.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
What year did you start doing stand-up?
Is this part of the...
We've recorded all of that.
Oh. Well, let me put my other voice on then, now that I know.
Who are you that have just come into the room? A second ago, Brian Regan was here. And...
Let me put on my personality hat. I started a long time ago, 1980.
80 was the year.
Yeah, 80 or 81. It's one of those 2 years. But I dropped out of college to try stand-up comedy.
Because that was... I feel like the mid-70s is when comedy seems to, like, really, you know, that's when Steve Martin started doing stuff and Richard Pryor and comedy had come out of the sort of nightclubby and really become a force of actual standalone entertainment.
Well, it was beginning. It hadn't quite exploded yet. It hadn't exploded at all. When I decided I wanted to be a comedian, the only comedy clubs that I knew about were in New York City and Los Angeles. And I was in college in Tiffin, Ohio, and I thought, I'm going to have to move to one of those two cities to try to be a stand-up comedian. And then I went down to Miami, Florida, where I grew up, and I looked in the Miami Herald, and there was a grand opening, an ad for the grand opening of the Comic Strip Comedy Club in Fort Lauderdale, sister club of the one in New York, open mic night. And I was like, wow. Like, it was just such a beautiful thing to have this place that I could drive, not my car, my parents' car, to try it.
Do you remember what your first set was?
My first set, I forget what the jokes were supposed to be because I blanked out.
Completely?
Complete blank out. I got on stage and I had every word memorized, you know, like, hi, how are ya? Was memorized, you know, written down and practiced. I got on stage. First thing I realized were the lights were brighter than what I expected. I said, hi, how are ya? I got feedback in the mic. It went, meow. And I ad-libbed. I said, well, I've already learned one thing. I don't know how to handle a microphone. And then everybody laughed, and my brain shut down.
Oh, no.
It just shut down. I couldn't remember anything, and I'm just on stage looking at these lights, just not knowing what to do. And I just started joking about how stupid I was that I couldn't remember my act, because it was an open mic night. Everybody knew I was an auditioner.
Sure.
And then they started laughing at that, and I ended up killing about this routine that I just winged about how stupid I was. And then I walked off stage, and I was like, I don't know what to think. And other comedians were coming up going, wow, that was cool how you pretended like you forgot your act. And I'm like, I didn't pretend that, man. And so that was my first time on stage.
Oh, wow. And then so the second time, did you do the rehearse bit, or did you like, yeah, maybe I should pretend that I don't remember?
I wasn't smart enough to do what I had learned the previous time. I went up and did the memorized stuff and bombed. But I'm so glad that I didn't do that the first time, because who knows if I would have quit.
If you ever would have gone back up again.
Right.
But or 1980 was... where people were really actually starting to make a career. Like, that seems like the beginning of, you know, clubs opening up everywhere.
Well, I mean, like 1980, this comedy club opened up in Fort Lauderdale. And then by the time I worked there for 2.5 years, just trying to get good enough to be able to work out on the road. And at the same time, concurrently, that's when comedy clubs were opening around the country. It could not have been more perfect. So I was able to book myself basically every week, not because I was any good, but there were clubs in every city at that point, and they needed comedians. If you could stand on stage and not melt for 30 minutes, you could get booked. So I was adequate enough to get booked. That's what I would call club bookers and go, if you're looking for somebody who's adequate, I'm your man.
Is this the bare minimum comedy club?
I can do the bare minimum necessary for you not to fire me before the weekend hits.
I am able to talk in front of people at a microphone,
and I won't run off the stage.
There won't be any negotiation.
No matter how bad it will be, and it will be bad, I will stay there my entire designated time.
I will distract these human beings so that they will buy alcohol and wings. And
I will be perfect before you'll have headliners, right? Funny people. I'll be perfect before funny people.
I will almost upset the crowd to a point that your headliner will
be so happy when the funny guy comes on stage.
Did you start getting to a point where when you were featuring, Were you kind of started outperforming the headliner? Did that start to become an issue?
Yeah, but I mean, that was never my quest. You know, I mean, I was just trying to get as good as I could be. I was never trying to. I never thought of it as a competition. You know, I never thought I was trying to be funnier than anybody else. In fact, that was always like an awkward compliment to get after a show. You know, when people would come up and like take you aside and whisper, you know, like they wanted to take you into a dark alley and go, you were funnier than a headliner, you know? And it's like, as much as I appreciated the effort at a compliment, I'd rather they just say I was funny. You know what I mean?
Right.
I thought you were funny. You don't have to go, you were funnier than that guy.
Yeah.
You know, like they're rearranging the show. Like,
no, we're going to drag him outside and kick the shit out of him. But just so you know. Yeah, I mean, I think people do kind of think that it needs to be like a one or the other sort of a thing, or they can't just appreciate the show as a whole.
Well, it's such a competitive world now that, I mean, that's people like to put things in a hierarchy, you know, and
right.
Decide who was the best and then second best. And it's like, can't everybody be funny in a different way?
Yeah. You know,
I mean, that was always my feeling.
Well, I think the problem is that a lot of people think comedy is one thing. They think it's one thing. They don't understand that there are sort of, you know, shades of comedy, subgenres of comedy. You know, you wouldn't go see a country band and be like, I wanted hip hop. You're like, well, right, should have done a little bit of research before left your home. But I think comedy is one of those things where I was just talking about it on At Midnight about doing warm up. And we're like, warm up is, I think, probably the hardest job in comedy. Like, doing warm up, it is terrifying and it's difficult and it's a nonstop juggling act, basically.
Do you do it?
No. Oh, okay. I mean,
have you done it?
I've never done it. I don't know if I would be. I think 5 minutes in, I'd be like, I don't know what else. I'm out. You're not giving me. Like, I would get to the point where I would have to drop the comedy act and be like, we're at odds now.
Plus, it was so. I mean, I would go watch Ray Romano tape his sitcom or Kevin James tape his sitcom, and you would watch the. I was just as intrigued with whoever was trying to warm up the crowd because I'm a comedian, you know, and I would love watching the warm-up people. And there was like no appreciation to the fact that they're working up to a punchline. Like as soon as they're ready to shoot, they just ring a bell,
oh, yeah.
You know, and it's like so they're in the middle of the punchline. So the guy said, "Bring," and I'll tell you after we shoot this scene, you know, and it's like, man, let the guy finish his joke.
No, I think comedy is always better when you stop in the middle of an act and then watch another scene unfold and then come back to the guy 9 minutes later.
Yeah, it's the anticipatory thing, yeah.
If I were doing warm up, then what I would do is not reset up the joke. I would just pick up exactly where I left off before and see if people would catch on.
Right.
But everyone thinks, you know, comedy is all one thing. Oh, it's all, you know, you can't just put the same guy as a warm up or in, you know, or doing colleges or doing clubs or doing theater. Like, there's so many different shades of it. And I think that's one of the things that's sort of frustrating is that it's underappreciated how many different types of comedy there are.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I always feel like you were saying, the music thing is a great example. You know, that's what was weird about a building called a comedy club. You know, I thought, how weird would it be to have a building called a music club?
Right.
You know, everyone likes music, but not everyone likes all kinds of music.
Right.
So it's the same with comedy. Who doesn't want to laugh? But not everybody's going to laugh at the same kinds of things. So I think that's why comedy dried up a little bit, is because people were going out and not necessarily seeing comedians that they liked. So then comedy had to kind of have a rebirth where it's like, all right, I like this kind of comedy, or I like that kind of comedy, or I like this person or that person.
Yeah. But you're a guy that that unifies – you're almost sort of the unified field theory of comedy. You tend I don't think I've ever talked to anyone that goes like, yeah, Brian Regan, I don't get it. Like everyone, even like the snobbiest comedy hipsters – it's like, yeah, Brian Regan's really fucking funny, or just across the board.
I'm hugely honored by that. I just want to make audiences laugh, but to the fact that some comedians might like what I do, it's just a huge honor.
No, yeah. I think all comedians like what you do, and I even can tell from people that I like performing, that comics that I like now, I see sort of, you know, like ancestry traces of, oh yeah, I can see the Brian Regan influence, and I can see I mean it's, you know, your comedy molecules are spread out into the world.
I'm just trying to get some people to laugh in the audience, and you know, that playing to the back of the audience, you know, playing to the back of the room, making comedians laugh, you know, that was part of it too, you know, but I never wanted to do it at the exclusion of the audience. You know what I mean? I'm a pig. I want everybody to like me.
But I think
I'm a creative pig.
All I've ever noticed, you know, the thing that I've noticed is that you have a tremendous amount of respect for your audience as people who came out and wanted to be entertained, and you are there to service them and make sure that they have a good time.
Sure. I mean, you know, it's like that's absolutely, they came out to have fun, and it's like that's kind of why we're all here, and I'll do my best. I will try at every moment that I'm on stage. That's all I can do. It might not work. You know what I mean? Like if, say, you're doing a corporate show or something like that and it's not necessarily working, I'm still trying. Every second I will try to turn this ship around, but sometimes it's not going to happen.
I don't know. I always just feel – I mean, and obviously this puts a lot of pressure on certain comedians, but I always think, oh, you know, guys like Jim Gaffigan or Brian Regan, they're bulletproof. They could – you know, like every room they could pull together.
No. I mean, now I'm fortunate enough where I'm performing in front of people who, you know, have a ticket that has my name on it, you know? So, but it wasn't always like that. You know, there would be plenty of nights where, you know, it just wouldn't click. And plus my comedy, you know, it's heightened reality. You know, I can get silly and I can get exaggerated and I can, you know, exaggerate a joke where I feel stupider than I really am or something like that. And if that heightened thing isn't working, that's a big fall. You know, you can't pretend like you were just talking.
Right.
You know, you can't pretend like you were just, you know, I didn't even mean for that to be funny. It's like, clearly that was supposed to be funny when I'm going, you too! You too, in case you ever fly someday! And if they're just looking at me, I can't, you know, shrug that off like I never intended that to be humorous.
I think you need to stay in that character and just go, so what else is going on in the world? Just stay that guy.
So it not only was it a bomb, those were big, big bombs. Those were big bombs.
Go down swinging.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always jealous of comedians who can be funny without going blue, and it's always the first place my brain goes, and I'm disappointed, and I'm trying to get out from under it, but you are able to not do that at all. I am so in awe of it, and I don't know how it works.
Well, I mean, when I first started, I had a handful of dirty jokes here and there, you know what I mean? I would use the F word. And a joke or two, and I have a sexual reference here and there, but it was always such a small percentage of my act. And so, you know, it isn't that I'm Johnny Wholesome, it's just because I'm anal that I want to be 100% something. I don't want to be 95% something. So it's just my anal quality kicked in that I became completely clean.
So there
a lot of people miss the point and think that, you know, like I somehow think it's loftier or better, and I don't feel that way at all. I mean, there are blue, filthy comedians who I think are geniuses. Richard Pryor, I think, is maybe the best stand-up comedian who ever lived. He worked blue. You know what I mean? I don't, it's just a different way of doing it. That's all. I just think it's different.
Yeah, and he also very much brought in this wave of people who were not doing like jokey jokes and really just these are conversations about my life.
Right.
And the fact that they were very authentic. I mean, I think ultimately there needs to be an authenticity, and you can tell if someone's being dirty just to try to get a rise out of the audience, and you can tell when it's an organic part of who they are,
right,
as a performer.
I mean, that's where I kind of, I don't say draw the line, like I'm who am I to be drawing lines, but I do agree that I think some people are cheating. You know what I mean? Like hitting the words because they know the audience wants to hear the word. I don't mind if you're saying it because this is what you want to say, but if you're hitting it because you think that they'll respond to it, then you're crossing a line that you shouldn't be crossing as a performer, you know? I always feel like we should be doing what we think is funny and not what they think is funny.
Right.
I always think that the moment you try to figure out what they think is funny, I think is when you start making a mistake.
Because you're trying to chase something
Well, what's the point of you being on stage? You're not supposed to give them what they want. You're supposed to give them what you want to give them.
Right.
You know what I mean? And hopefully they're going to agree. You know what I mean? If they don't agree, you don't have a career. You don't have, you know what I mean? You want them to agree on some of it, but, you know, otherwise I feel like you're hitting buttons, you know, you're just on stage hitting buttons.
When you get used to performing for people who are coming out because your name's on the ticket, was it ever rocky if you just went into a club and just did a drop-in set and no one expected you to be there? And then, in other words, the curve between going back to performing for people who didn't 100% know who you were versus that kind of, you know, when people know who you are, you get a huge pass because they're excited to see you.
Not necessarily. I here's what happens when I go into a comedy club on the road. Like, I'll finish my show, we'll go over to the comedy club, you know, and it feels good. Hey, I'm going back to a comedy club. I walk in and there's a person behind the podium who looks at me and says, "It's $12 cover." They have no clue. They have no clue. And it's like kind of an ego hit, you know, where I have to go, is there a way that I don't have to pay the cover charge?
I just played at a venue that has a bank's name in front of it, and I feel like
I should. I mean, I have the $12. I do, but I just feel in the principle of the thing, I shouldn't be giving it to you to come in here. But, and even like if I occasionally do a guest set, you know, it's weird. Like, I have a following, but many, 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 many more people don't know who I am than do know who I am, even in a comedy club. I've gone on in guest sets and like the MC being very gracious and kind and nice will make it sound like some star has walked in. And so I think they're expecting Jay Leno to hit the stage or something like that. And then they'll go, "Brian Regan." And I can hear people, "I never heard of this guy. Have you heard of this guy? Do you know who he is?" You know what I mean? So I got to go up there and earn it just like everybody else at night.
Yeah. Guys, I just came over from an arena. I want to make it clear that I've just come over from the largest venue in your town.
I don't like to play that card.
You can't.
Though, you know what I mean? And I love the anonymity, but it amazes me how anonymous. Like, I can literally play like a big venue, right? I could go a half a mile down the road after the show to go into Burger King, and no one in there knows who I am. And I'm like, how is that possible that half a mile that way, I'm like, you know, big man on campus, and over here, nothing.
Because entertainment now particularly is so splintered. And everyone, you know, there's a niche audience for everything, and people don't know. It's not like it was in the 80s where everyone just watched the same things. Everyone just saw the same things and watched the same things. And now it's, you know, the kid that's working at Burger King is watching other things on YouTube versus the people that, you know, came to see your show. But you built such an incredible following of what I assume to be essentially relentless touring over the years, which seems like it just, you know, do you ever take a break, or is it always like 40 weeks a year?
No, I do half the weekends of the year. I do 26 weekends a year, and I do 4 one-nighters in that weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So, I mean, I'm always on tour, but I take plenty of time off in between.
Yeah, and then each new tour, is it 100% new stuff? Is that your...
No, it's just ever evolving. You know what I mean? It's just like if you go back to a city 2 years later, I'm hoping that that audience will see, who knows, 60-70% new stuff or more, you know. I mean, I'm really looking forward to doing this special because I want to move on from this material. You know, as much as I want to do it and be done with it, I'm looking forward to the material that I'm not doing, you know.
What's your cycle for the special? How long does it take you to do a new special and get through the material?
Well, normally I would like to record something like every 2 to 3 years, but it's been like 5 since the last thing I did. I did a CD, and so it's been a little bit too long, so I'm getting kind of antsy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You must be ready to purge.
Yeah, that's why I want to move on.
Because it really does force you to like, oh, can't touch that anymore.
Right.
People have already seen it.
Right.
And then will you do the do you do any TV or anything else to support it, or do you get to tour just on the strength of the fact that you release specials every so often and that you tour regularly?
Am I doing TV to support the special?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, like, will you go do sets on, you know, like, well, now Colbert? Will you go do sets on the...
I'm going to do the Tonight Show that week.
Oh, fantastic.
With Jimmy Fallon on that Wednesday, and then the special is that Saturday. I'm doing the Today Show Friday. I'm not sure who's interviewing me. I thought Matt Lauer, but somebody said maybe not. I don't know. But
thank God they're not like, go do stand-up. People will think it's fun. No, it's morning, and it's not a good time for...
I'm never comfortable in those environments, so... I'm the only person telling people not to watch me on the Today Show. You can watch me sit on a couch and look very lame and boring while somebody asks me questions on the Today Show. I've never felt that's my... You know, I like to be on stage doing that thing. That I know how to do. Conversations, I'm always like quite uncomfortable with them.
You seem fine now.
Well, this is a false exterior. I'm putting a facade on.
I mean, you're scratching a lot of the skin off your face. But
well, you're doing we're talking about comedy, and you're asking very good questions, so I feel more comfortable than I am oftentimes.
Oh, when you got to go do the morning TV show, when you're doing the, you know, when you're performing in a city, you're like, go do the morning TV show. And you go like, Brian Regan, Brian, yeah. I understand that recently, where they're trying to set you up for a bit. Like, this is so.
Yeah, one time I'm doing some good morning whatever show, and they said, we're going to tease to you, go stand over by the camera, and we're going to say that you're going to be coming up after the break. So when we point at you, do something for 20 seconds. Do something funny for 20 seconds. What should I do? Well, you've come up with it. You're the monkey. You're the funny monkey boy. So, as far as I know, no one's coming back after commercial break because they go, and we're going to be back with him. And I stand there and I just blaze my eyes into the camera for 20 seconds. If you want to see more of a guy looking awkward and staring blankly into a camera, we're going to have more of that on the other side of these commercials.
And then when you come back, did you actually do the interview afterwards?
Sure, sure. So, Brian, are you funnier on stage than you are doing teases?
Don't talk to me. I'm staring.
Where's the camera? I want to burn a hole in it.
I'm staring at it. I can see your soul. I can see your soul, Dubuque. Wherever you were, yeah, it is. It's sort of hard because I think, especially in a lot of those towns, like there seems to be the same delineation of there's a couple of people who work on the show that are they've been there a long time, they don't give a shit anymore. To them it's just I got to show up and do this job and then I'm gonna go home. And there's always kind of a younger person that's a little out of touch but wants to be, hey man, I don't know what these other guys are. And you're coming into basically a pre-existing inside joke that you don't know what any of the reference points are.
I did one time, and it was a man and a woman co-host, right? And the woman really thought I was funny. She told me before the interview, and you know, it made me feel great. And then we get out there and we're doing the interview, so the three of us are on camera, right? And she's sitting next to me and she's laughing I'm trying to squeeze bits in and she's laughing hysterically, which makes me feel tremendous. But he don't want to give it up. He don't want to give it up. And he thinks it'll be funny to be rolling his eyes like I don't get my co-host and why she thinks this is so funny. And it was just, you know, why does it have to be this awkwardness, you know?
Oh, because I hate my mom. I've got a lot of problems with women. I don't like my mom. Yeah. I'm not happy as a person. Anyway, you're going to be
that
over
probably
at the...
is right.
Yeah, it's. I think
to have to do, you know, a couple hours of morning television or morning radio every morning, I think is probably soul crushing, because it you know, to have to fill that much time every day and be up here, like, I can't imagine.
And I'm not, you know, like radio hosts or whatever, I'm not belittling them. I'm the one that I know that that's not my skill set. You know what I mean? You know, whenever they say, well, just jump in when you feel like it, I feel like saying, then you might as well just bring me back to the hotel, because I'm not a jump in guy.
What if I don't feel like it?
If there's a pool, I'm not jumping in the pool. You have to ask me questions. If you don't ask me questions, I'm just going to sit there.
Do you ever?
Yeah, my publicist is probably listening, thinking, you shouldn't be telling these stories about how bad you are at show business. But, you know, I know what I can do, and I know what I don't do well. I don't care.
Do you ever feel that thing after a show where you just sort of feel, this is going to sound morose and I don't mean it to, but do you ever feel that thing where you've just like scooped out so much at a show that you kind of just go back to your hotel and you just feel a little like sad and empty? Do you ever feel that after shows?
I do, with how quickly a theater can empty.
Yeah. You know,
talk about feeling used. You know, you got pedal to the metal for an hour. Good night, everybody. And then you walk off stage and you look out and you see like three people left. And you're like, well, we had our fill of that guy. Now we're going to get on with our lives.
I would have left after 20 minutes, but that would have been rude.
I'm just waiting for you to say goodnight. So it's like, don't we cuddle? Isn't there cuddling afterwards?
But you do. But you, at this point, though, I would imagine you probably kind of have it pretty well down.
I mean, what? I'm sorry.
Mentally, you kind of have it down.
Yeah, I mean,
like,
you know what
I
have little tricks I can do to placate my soul so I don't feel worthless. Yeah, I can look in the mirror and give me some pep talks, get myself some pep talks every now and then.
The audience isn't really here, so it doesn't matter. They're all a figment of your imagination, an extension of your ego.
You know, one of the weirdest shows I did, I was... Before I performed in theaters myself, I was lucky enough to open for Jerry Seinfeld, and he performed at a theater, I think it was in Houston, and it was one of the first theaters I'd ever been in, performing in. And I walked on stage, literally, there were like 4,000 people in there. Literally, I could see zero of them. Zero. You couldn't even see the front row. The lights were so bright, and the stage was configured in a way that you couldn't see anybody. And I walk out there and I'm like, how bizarre is this? I'm playing supposedly to human beings, and I'm making this big black wall with white lights in it laugh. And it was so surreal, because you're hearing 4,000 people. They're laughing, and then you say goodnight, and you walk off stage and go, what the hell was that all about? Like, it was just... like, I literally didn't see a soul.
Oh, I forgot to tell you, we died on the way to the theater.
It was very... And I was thinking it could have been like a...
Thank God.
I'm sure he would have been able to... That's
We're not great... alive anymore. Oh. Oh, no.
Oh. Oh, wow.
Yeah, if you're funny enough, you get into the afterlife. Anyway, I should have told you that before, but maybe it's better I didn't. So good job.
I didn't want to spook you out before you get out there.
Is there a horrible thing that someone can say to you right before you go on stage? Do you have any buttons where it's like, please don't do that right before I go on stage?
One is family stuff, you know, like a family problem or something like that. You know, you don't want to get if I get any phone calls from any brothers or sisters, because my parents are both, you know, they're about to turn 89 years old. Any phone call or text from any brother or sister within an hour and a half before the show, I'm not taking. Because I don't want to get that call that, you know, somebody's not around anymore and then have to go on stage. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that was a pretty dark answer.
No, but a very...
So the answer is, I don't want to be told my mom is dead.
Great to be here. Not really.
Well, Brian, that answers that question. Yeah.
That would be like Brian Regan goes super dark on stage. It was weird. He didn't do any jokes. He just talked about mortality for like 80 minutes.
He must have gotten a phone call he didn't want to get.
Oh, cell phones. Well, that's what's so... Yeah, I mean, like, you know, in the 80s, there was less of a chance of that happening because you'd have to call in to check your messages.
Right. Someone could find out immediately.
Yeah, now they can tell you right away. Well, they should... You know, don't they have the decency to die after the encore?
Don't they? They have my webpage. They know when my shows are. You're going to die on a Saturday. I'm playing Radio City. Jeepers.
Typical parents crushing the dreams. This is exactly what I went through my entire life.
Oh, man. No, this is going to be one of these horrible, ironic things. And then after he did that podcast.
No. No, we do not have that much power in the universe. If we do, then that would be really awful. We should use that for good, not to kill people's parents. That would be a terrible way to it'd be a terrible way to go about
use it
that.
For good instead of evil.
I always kind of get nervous when, you know, someone's like, oh, I have friends. For some reason, like friends, like family or friends make me kind of nervous. Like if they're strangers, it doesn't bother me as much. But if it's like, oh, you know, your aunt, and she's brought some friends from her bridge club. And then I'm always like, oh, no, because then they're the ones that you'll really hear about what they thought about it afterwards.
I have that. I'm okay with them being in the audience. I do not want to see them. I don't want to see them, you know, and I guess that would be a horrible thing to hear before a show. I put your parents in the front row.
You know, also, they died. Just so maybe this was.
It's and they're not alive.
Anyway, have a good set.
Them, and you can
have a
see
good
them.
Full house tonight. Good job, Brian. Good job. Do you want anything? Do you want a water? Or you? Oh my God! What are you telling me?
I mean, I've seen cousins and nephews and stuff in the front row, and it's like after the show, it's like the first thing I have to talk about with the tour people. It's like, you can't do that, man. You can't put people I know in the front. It's really, really disarming.
What do you think it is that's weird about it?
It's just, you know, I don't know. I think comedy, for me, comedy is best in front of strangers.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I mean, not that I'm not so naive to realize that there aren't people in the audience that I know, but I'm trying to make this room full of strangers, people laugh, you know? One of the first times I tried it in college was with all my friends. You know, I knew I wanted to be a comedian. And so they set this thing up where I would do comedy at the campus bar. And it's all my friends in the audience. And it's like, it doesn't work because I'm on stage trying to go into these premises, you know, going, hey, well, I was on a bus today. And they're like, no, you weren't. Well, I know I wasn't really, but let's just pretend for a moment. Well, it's hard for us to do because we were with you all day.
It's amazing how you're all able to talk in unison that way. You're one collective mind.
One collective mindset. Now speaking out together.
Yeah, I get kind of weirded out and I really appreciate when. Because there, you know, people will come to multiple shows. Like the same people will come to multiple shows, and I do appreciate it. But I always get it's so funny how in my head I can get about one person as opposed to a lot of people going, I know they know what this joke is that I'm about to tell, and I feel weird about it. And they don't because they know what they made the choice,
right?
But I still can't help but get in my head about it. Are you the same?
I try. I used to not like looking at the person who isn't laughing. I was doing a show at, I forget what club it was, a comedy club, and I'm on stage, and there were two women sitting next to each other, like three tables back, but they were underneath a canned light, so I could see both of them. And not only did they not like me, they needed their faces to show that they didn't like me. They needed me to know that they didn't like me. And they were both just staring at me. Clearly, I didn't have them. And yet I was you know, kind of killing with everybody else, but I couldn't help but I kept peeking over at these two, and one in particular. I mean, she was a physical presence. She was very large and just staring at me like, I don't, if her body language could talk, it was like, you're not funny. So I finally did one joke that, you know, the biggest laugh I'm capable of getting, like, and boom, everybody's laughing. So I look over at her like to think, well, maybe this is the one. And I looked at her, and while everyone's laughing, I looked at her, and she's staring at me, and I like shook my head like, not even that one? And she shook her head back like, not even that one. And I laughed on stage like I had this aside with this person who clearly doesn't like me. Like, we communicated. You know, it was weird that was happening while other people were enjoying it.
But there's something kind of fun about the fact that you acknowledged your sort of arch nemesis position. I'll see you at the next show.
I know you're my enemy, but I want you to know I know about you.
Not even that one. That makes me. But sometimes I feel like you know, because comics can get so in their heads about what the audience is thinking, and I think sometimes it's best in. And that's a specific situation, what you just said. But sometimes, haven't you ever the experience where you go like, God, this wasn't a good show. I don't know what the fuck. And then afterwards they're like, we thought you were so great. And then you find out, oh, they're just not effusive. They're just kind of, some people just sit there politely. Like, we'll let him talk. But then afterwards it seems like, oh, they actually had a good time.
It's hard for me still, you know, I mean, I've been doing this a while. It's still hard for me not to say after a show that I wasn't happy with a show, because like you're saying, people like it and they don't know how you did the night before. They don't know that you felt you crushed the night before. So you're working your way to get through a set. Those people in the audience could be having a perfectly fine time. And then like, I have to learn how to not say, I didn't like it so much. You know, like if they say, hey, I enjoyed the show, I just got to go, well, thank you. You know, but I'm still trying to learn that.
Well, that's why I think it's so funny when people, when you get into a tiff with someone on the internet and people go, well, don't pay attention to the trolls. And you're like, but you don't understand. My profession conditions me to find the one person in the audience who's not enjoying themselves and deal with them, or the heckler and right. deal with them. That's what we're conditioned to do.
Right, exactly. They exist, and you can't, you know, it's hard to pretend like that they don't exist. With, you know, a room full of people, one heckler, that's the one that you have to take on.
Do you enjoy that part of the process? Does it sort of keep it fresh and fun, or would you prefer that no one speak out ever during the shows?
Well, I mean, you can divide hecklers into friend and foe, you know. I mean, you get your friendly hecklers who are still sometimes messing up the show because they're yelling at inappropriate times. But they don't know they're messing up the show. They're just yelling their favorite sports team, or they're yelling a bit that they want to hear. You know what I mean? But they're not necessarily trying to harm you.
Right.
So you have to handle that differently, obviously, than somebody that's yelling, you're not funny, you never have been funny, and you never will be funny. You know, somebody that has that.
Paid $45 just to make sure you knew that.
If they have that explicit of a heckle, you know. But those kind of hecklers, I always think, are much rarer than people think. Most people aren't that mean.
Right.
You know, I mean, I can count on one hand that the amount of times that somebody has been that mean-spirited, you know.
Especially at this point, if they came to see your show specifically, they're really kind of shooting themselves in the foot. If they're to say something like that, like, well, but you came here on purpose,
right?
As opposed to, you know, if you're just in a random club and some guy's drunk and he wants to hear jokes about poop and you're not telling poop jokes or whatever. I guess my point is more poop jokes.
guess what I'm writing tonight?
You know, I've been resistant to it, but it is funny.
Sure.
Are there types of? Do you ever think of things that? Because your voice is so – I assume that your voice is so strong that you can essentially – even if you just started describing anything, it would come out as a Brian Regan bit, you know? Like that you kind of – you know how to say something in a way that automatically frames it in a comedic way. But are there things that you go, well, you know, this doesn't really – I think this is funny, but this doesn't really fit my voice at all?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think of very dark, twisty things. Sometimes I wonder sometimes, could I ever, you know, experiment and play around with a darker type of comedy. Right now, you know, it's like I do shows now where sometimes people bring kids. You know, it's not a kiddie show, but like you look out in the audience and there's a 9-year-old girl holding a red balloon. You know, I don't want to tell a joke that's going to send reverberations up the string and make her balloon pop. You know, but I do wonder if there could be a time in my career, who knows, where I could just go into clubs and do a twistier side, you know, and show a more demented side, because it's there. I mean, you know, I have a personality that includes, you know, the kind of comedy I do on stage, but I can also be kind of off the tracks.
I think, you know, I think the place to do that would be like, you know, if you're in New York, drop by UCB one night, or drop by UCB here, or our, you know, or our Nerd Melt Theater over. These are places where you can do that and go, I think, pretty – it wouldn't touch the rest of your career. And I think those people would really – I think it could be really interesting. But I think it'd be a safe zone for you to try that kind
would
of
I
stuff.
Be able to say a word like shit?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, if it was at UCB, you could actually shit on stage. And they still would not be fazed.
Oh, you could point at the shit and call it shit.
This is what, this is literally a poop joke. I mean, you could do that. And I think that in some senses they would respect it.
Wow.
But you can. I mean, you could, you know, those are the places where you can be more experimental. And because it's so low impact in terms of, like, you know, the people that are going to UCB at 11 o'clock at night are not going to the big arena. They're separate audiences. But I don't know. It's just something to think about if you wanted to experiment. Even one time, you could get a sense of whether or not you thought it worked.
It's intriguing, you know. I'll write down some four-letter words and memorize them.
It's just no jokes. You know when you're choke-fucking a dog to death? Oh, my God, what happened? And then someone puts it on the internet. Oh, man. You said this wouldn't touch my career. I got to choke-fuck more dogs to death. Just to feel.
Wow. It would probably just be the kind of stuff I do, but with curse words in it. What the fuck is with fucking Pop-Tarts? You know, you're God damn it, you're sitting there reading the motherfucking directions, and you're going, 3 seconds, are you fucking kidding me? No fucking way. And then you think you're done with that, and you go, holy motherfucking shit, microwave directions. Anyway, you guys have been great. I go, wait, that was a 30-second joke. Now it's a 2-minute joke. Oh, I see.
I feel so alive. But that's even if you just did that. I know this is an alternative room. It's a little bit edgier, so I'm taking some of my old material and spicing it up a bit just for you guys.
I hope you enjoy it. You're going to bleep all those out, right?
Well, I don't know if...
Oh, well.
Oh, well. It's all... God damn it. No, but it is... It could be a fun place for you to... Because, you know, ultimately, I'm sure as a performer, there's stuff that you feel like you can't... You know, do you ever feel... I don't know. Imprisoned is kind of the wrong word, but just sort of like... I'm a little kind of... if I want this to continue, it kind of has to stay in this region.
Well, it's a very interesting question, because I have tried to be careful my whole career not to allow myself to be painted into a corner. You know, as soon as I feel like I'm being overly defined a certain way, I would always write away from it. Instead of going towards it, I would write away from it. I never wanted to be something you could easily hang your hat on. You know, there was a while when I was like, I was doing victim comedy, you know, feeling stupid. And then I would start reading articles, oh, he's the guy that always feels like an idiot. Not in a negative way, but it was like I was being defined that way. So I was like, all right, I'm not writing any more jokes like that. Now I started writing anger fantasies and, you know, changing the kind of stuff I would do. And then like the crouching around on stage, you know, some people would say, oh, he's the guy that always crouches around on stage. I'm like, well, I don't want to be like a cartoon, so I'm going to show these people that I can stand upright, you know. So I would always work away from it, and I don't know if at some point the clean thing would be part of that. I don't know. Because clean is what I respond to. Not that it's clean, but it's just everyday stuff, you know? So that's what I gravitate towards. But lately I've been, I don't know why, I'm like fascinated with foreign policy and politics. And it's like, I'm writing jokes that cut your audience in half. You know what I mean? Because they take a position. And, But I want to do them. You know what I mean? And so who knows? I just want to be ever evolving, if you will.
Well, I don't think you'd be happy if you did jokes. It's because it's exactly what you said. And then at that point, you're just doing it for the audience and you're not doing it for yourself anymore.
Correct.
And so, you know, you can't. I feel like that'd be a tough thing to sustain for any length of time because it really would be those moments after a set where you kind of feel a little, you'd feel a little extra, and I didn't even really care about what I was saying on stage.
Right. I mean, that, and that's something that I always try to be careful of and make sure that I'm hitting things. I mean, I still do things that are important to me and that, you know, interest me, but they are on the, you know, the cleaner side of the tracks, I guess. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, you look at George Carlin. I mean, his later career, he was certainly a different comedian than he was at the start of his career. You know, he was doing hippy-dippy weatherman, and then later he's doing social consciousness stuff and talking about whether God exists. And Richard Pryor, same thing. You know, his early years, he was definitely doing a different thing than he did later in his career. So I think if you're a comedian, there should be an arc to it. You know, there should be a growth to it. And so I try to be open to that and make sure that I allow that to happen for me.
Did you ever do you have any stories about realizing that one of your ultimate heroes was in the audience and then you had to go on stage and then you – or were you – you know, you're very comfortable on stage so you don't think about that stuff. But like, was Carlin ever in the audience or any of those guys? Did you ever perform for them?
No, I never had the – good fortune to ever meet George Carlin. I would have liked to.
Oh my God, that's crazy. Really?
No, I never. I mean, I saw him perform. In fact, I was working at a comedy club in Atlantic City, okay? And George Carlin was playing like in the main room, okay? And so we finished our show and the guys from the club were able to get us to slip us up into the back of the theater. So I go up in the back of the theater. I'm watching George Carlin on stage. You know, like, could there be a bigger legend in comedy than George Carlin? And he's not having a good show. So I'm fascinated. I'm fascinated watching George Carlin, who was one of the best comedians who's ever lived. I'm fascinated in just watching him. But I'm also fascinated that he's not having a good show. And while I'm watching, this Jersey guy and his wife gets up and start walking out. They had to walk past me to get to the exit. And this guy, I overhear this guy go, "This guy don't know nothing about comedy." And I wanted to grab him and go, "Do me a favor. You go find the guy that knows more about comedy than that guy and bring him to me because I would love to meet him. The guy that knows more about comedy than that guy."
"Oh, it's Vinny Raborino, my butcher. The guy's a fucking riot.
He always, you know this guy puts his hand under his arm and he makes armpit fart noises.
This guy's talking about how we should open our minds and think freer and accept everyone. I don't got time for that shit."
I mean, nothing against Jersey. I love performing in Jersey. That's just where this happened to be.
And I say, fuck you. I'm kidding, because when I take the other side of it. Just thought it'd be fun to...
point, counterpoint.
Point, counterpoint. All my counterpoints. And but I say, fuck yourself.
Okay, yeah. Well, it's hard to...
I have no facts.
Come back on that.
Nothing is just...
Wouldn't it be great to see him in one of these debates, you know, like somebody lays out their economic policy and then go to the other guy, "Well, I say fuck you."
That's going
to
be Trump. 100%.
Yeah, we do have that going.
We do have that guy
we
right
do
now.
Have that guy.
It is I'm 100% shocked that they just haven't cut back to him and his dick's out. Like, "Oh, I'm sorry."
Does that answer your question?
You going to apologize for that?
Why?
I'll apologize when I'm wrong. Oh, Jesus Christ. Yeah, I don't know, man. It's each week that goes by, I keep going like, "Please, gonna say something that's impossible to come back from." And it just seems like the further out he goes, and the less apologetic he is, the more people are like, "Oh, I guess we gotta follow that guy."
It's like the Twilight Zone episode. There was a Twilight Zone episode of a comedian. I think he went to hell. Oh, I wish I could remember this exactly. And he's on stage and bombing, and that's going to be his eternity. Is people like not enjoying it
ever? But,
yeah, and they keep laughing more and more at, like, "Oh, he's just telling painful stories," and they're just laughing more and more. So I just wonder if the political thing, like, it doesn't matter how far he goes, people just like it more and more. It's weird watching the graph.
Yeah, I feel like sooner or later, though, he's got to... Because there have been a couple points where you're like, really? That didn't undo him? Wow, okay. What is right. that? Like,
it's, the McCain thing, you know, you would have thought, you know, once you're, like, denouncing a hero...
Yeah.
You think that would do it. I actually, you know, I don't know. I'm intrigued with the whole thing, though. I'm intrigued with the fact that he says what he likes. I like that because too many politicians are, you know... very controlled in what they say. So there is a refreshing quality to it.
Yes, there is, but it's just unfortunately like a lot of what he's saying, you're like, no, you shouldn't be so, what are you, why? You know?
Understood.
But I do get that part of it that, because again, people want authenticity. And so if someone is saying something that they believe and they are true to what they're saying, there is something that I think is magnetic about that in a realm where you know everyone's basically pandering to you because they want you to like them. Mm-hmm. And I think there are some interesting lessons about comedy from watching this scramble, which is exactly what you were saying earlier. Like when you know the audience knows when you're pandering to them, and I think they also can tell, unless you're a master, they know when you're telling them the truth mm-hmm. at the same time. And that's why, because I would always wonder, there's some guys where they're super funny and they kill in a club, but then the audience leaves and they're like, oh, that guy was really funny. What are you talking about? I don't know. He's just really funny. And then someone, you know, a Louis type of comic gets on stage. He tells some personal stories and it's really sticky with people for some reason. It's like, they felt like they got a piece of that person. Mm-hmm. And it seems like, you know, even if they don't agree with the thing that they saw, they still, you know, like they're taking away something.
Well, I mean, I agree. I think comedy, you know, I hate when people are only seeking out things they agree with. You know, it's okay to enjoy a political comedian who's on the opposite side completely of how you feel. You know, I used to love watching Paul Mooney in New York. I would perform at Caroline's and he would do The Late Show and I would sit in the back and watch. And you know, he wasn't very always kind to white people, you sure. know, but I loved it. I loved hearing, I'm talking about it in his comedy, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He has a perspective. He's an African-American and he's doing comedy from his perspective and his life. And I would love watching the comedy through his prism, you know, and I think, you know, too many people, like, they hear something that they don't agree with on stage and you get offended by it and like, humph, I'm going to walk out. Why does it scare you to hear something you don't agree with?
Right. Why do you have to agree with it? Well,
you don't have to agree with the person.
Especially we're, you know, our culture is so coddled by the like button and people are so spoiled with, well, everything that entertains me has to be exactly like every other thing that I like. And if it's not, then I don't have time for it. And, you know, and so it is. I think a lot of audiences don't understand, like, look, you just have to do 15% of the work, 10% of the work. Just come a little open-minded, just come and allow yourself to be swept right. away and don't defensively be like, you better make me laugh, and if you don't say what I like, then I'm going to walk out, you know, like the guy at the George Carlin show.
Yeah, to me it's like, you know, the performer's building half the bridge, the audience should build half the bridge,
yeah.
you know? You meet in the middle. It's like you got to do some work out there. You know, I don't want to just come out with a big platter of shiny things. Do you like my platter of shiny things, you lazy? You know, it's like I like them to complete a joke in their head and go, okay, I see where you're going, you know.
But I do think that at this point, you know, people do that. I mean, I think your audiences are conditioned enough to know your audiences, people like comedy, I would imagine. Like if they come to see you time and time again, and how many tours is this? Can you even count how many tours?
I don't start them and end them. I just want it to be continuous.
Yeah.
When I first started performing in theaters, everyone was telling me you got to title it. You got to title it, and it's like I was so resistant to it. So I titled one, and then a year later they go, all right, what's the new title? I'm like, well. The last thing wasn't a thing with a beginning, middle, and an end. It's just me doing stand-up. And so I just said, I'm not titling them anymore. It's just me on tour doing stand-up and just come and check it out. So so the tour is, there's no start to it. There's no end to it. It's just, I'm always out there.
And where are you able to try large swaths of new material? Can you just do that?
I just do them on stage. I mean, when I first started, I was a little reluctant, you know, thinking, wow, these people paid to see a show. But it's like, well, wait, no, this is what I do. This is my craft, and you're here to watch how I do it. And so I just work it into the shows.
Yeah. And do you ever acknowledge if it's...
Sure.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah. I mean, it depends on how much they didn't laugh. You know what I mean? You know, if there's enough of a chuckle where you can pretend like that's what it was supposed to get, you can move on. But crowds are cool. They'll give you foul balls, you know? They'll give you foul balls, you know? The greatest hitter in the world is going to hit one into the stands. People aren't going to just start booing, you know? So, but once you hit too many foul balls, then I have to shut down the new stuff sometimes, you know?
Is there one quality that you think is the most important thing for a comic to have, whether it be, could just be like, oh, funny or honest or, you know, daring or bold? Like, is there one thing that you think a comic really should be on stage?
Wow. Boom, boom, boom. I don't know if this answers the question directly, but, you know, it speaks to what I was saying before about, you know, trying to figure out what audiences want. You know, I think unique is the answer to that, because I think when I'm on stage and I feel like I'm not having a good show, what comforts me is going, forget about these people. I shouldn't be trying to make them laugh. I imagine me out in the middle of the audience and I go, make me laugh. What would I laugh if I was out just sitting in the middle of the audience? And it comforts me and it gets me back to how I think I'm funny. Now, sometimes that'll turn a crowd around and sometimes it won't, but at least I'm being true to myself. So, you know, I always think the more unique a comedian is, the more interested I am as a, you know, an observer. You know, I love not being able to guess comedians' punchlines.
Yeah.
If I just can't guess them, I'm entertained.
Yeah.
Like if they set something up and you go, please don't go, please don't do this.
Right.
Please don't say what I think you're going to say. Please. And if they say it, it's so disappointing. You go, oh, man, you know. But if they just say anything other than what I think they're going to say, I'm like, yeah. you know, that's a success to me.
I kind of wonder if maybe going in the direction that you predict is because they're trying to land it in the audience's lap. They're trying to go, well, this is where the audience would expect to go, and I gotta bring it to them, as opposed to, you know, if someone's being authentic to themselves – that's where it's impossible. I mean, like, there are some performers, you know, people like Maria Bamford or people where you see them and you go, yeah, no one else could do that act,
right,
because
right.
It's so much a part of who that person is. It is you could not transmute that to any other comedian and have it work. Those are the, you know, those kinds of people really, I'm always so blown away
by. I agree. I think she's fantastic. I love watching her stuff. I love watching the characters she lives out on stage. They're so beautifully unique and interesting. Yeah, I mean, she's a perfect example.
Do you watch a lot of comedy? Do you try to keep up with who's doing what, or did you not want that in your head?
I go through phases. You know, I mean, there are times when I really don't want to be... well, part of it, I don't like to watch sometimes just because it's like, I want to be off. I want to not be a comedian. You know?
Right.
I'm a daddy. I've got two kids. I like to live that world. And but, you know, I have the Sirius XM and I'll, you know, occasionally listen to the comedians, and I have comedians who are friends. They perform in Las Vegas. I'm going to go out and see their show just to be a supporter and that sort of thing. So there are times when I'll want to know what people are doing, but not so much to guide me, but just to kind of know what's out there.
Did your earlier stuff, are you okay with it? Or do you look back and you go, ah, oh, what was I? Oh, come on.
I watched an old tape of mine that had been done years ago, a local talk show in South Florida, and it was local comedians going on. It was about the Comic Strip Comedy Club and the new wave of comedy. And I braced myself to cringe, like, you know what I mean? And when I watched it, I mean, I was very green, and some of the jokes were like, yeah, that's a little so-so. But there were enough things in there that were peculiar and different. It made me feel good to go, I think I was on the correct path even back then. You know, even though I hadn't completely figured out how to be unique and interesting. But at least there was enough interesting things in there where I was like, okay, I wasn't a hack, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I hadn't quite figured my path out yet, but it was okay, you know.
So you think...
probably good for a performer to maybe write out their first idea for a joke and then go, okay, I know I can go this place with it, but is there another level deeper? Is there another weird place that I can go with it? Or is there another take on it? Do you think it needs to be that self-conscious, or do you think it's like, eh, just write whatever you think is fun?
Well, I mean, if it's their idea for a joke, it might not already exist out in the world. But I mean, there are common premises that people can go to, and like, people are going to think the same thing. And, you know, it's that concept of low-hanging fruit, you know what I mean? It's like, well, it's easy to pick low-hanging fruit, go above it. That's why I used to watch, I used to love Dave Letterman interviewing people in the audience, you know, and they would say something, they would have a silly name, or they would like say something that was so easy to attack comedically, and he went around it. He wouldn't go for it. And I just, I would admire the hell out of that. It's like he's not going for the low-hanging fruit. He's going beyond it. And that's what I think comedians should be doing. It's like, well, you know, don't always go for the easy thing. Try to make it a little bit more challenging, you know.
I
say that, and my act is me crossing my eyes and hunching over on stage.
Oh, you're... You're the cross-eyed hunchover guy.
So if you want to hear some Pop-Tart humor.
You know, Pop-Tarts are higher on the tree than you might think.
I feel like I'm talking about somebody else here. Now, if there could only be a comedian that could live up to what I'm talking about.
But
it ain't
that
me.
Time, but it's, I mean, like, talk show stand-up can be dicey because... So, some of the talk shows, like, the setup is weird. The audience is a mile away from the stage. Sometimes they're kind of distracted. They're not always mic'd very well. Like, I feel like there are so many things that almost get in the way of comedy, like doing talk show comedy. When was the first time you did a Tonight Show?
I was lucky enough to get on a year before Johnny Carson retired, and I believe it was 1991.
Yeah, and how was it?
It went. I was happy with it.
Oh, good.
Yeah. I picked all the low-hanging fruit I could pick. No, it was, you know, it went okay, yeah.
Good. Did he call you over? Did you talk to him?
Not because of the set. You know, I mean, like, I always make the distinction. You know, there's, like, that lore, if you will, of, like, people killing, and then he goes, hey, come on over. I got to go over afterwards because a guest didn't show up.
Uh-huh.
And so they let me go back out and do 5 more minutes on the panel at the end of the show.
I think you should just assume that your set was so good, the guest was like, well, I can't follow that, so I'm just going to not show up.
No. I mean, you know, I just would be careful never to include myself in the company of people who he did that with, you know. So
that's kind of funny where you're – what you'll allow yourself as – like how you reward yourself. And you go, I want to make it very clear that was not – that, well, I'm not saying that.
Yeah,
that
I mean, it would be kind of easy for me to go, yeah, I went over and did panel one. It's like, well, wait a second. There was a story to it. It was sort of like a weird way that it happened. But,
well, not everyone would admit that. So I think you should give yourself some cool points for that. But when you're writing, do you write word for word anymore, or do you just go, well, this is in the neighborhood of what I want to do, and I'll work it out on stage?
I'm not good at coming up with an idea with a blank piece of paper in front of me. You know, if I have a blank piece of paper in front of me, that piece of paper will just remain blank. I don't, you know, sometimes I'll go, come on, comedy. Come on, come out of me. And it doesn't come out of me. So I know that doesn't work for me.
It's like you're trying to exercise yourself.
Come on, I know you're in there. You're hiding in there somewhere. I just have to live my life. I have to go walk around and do what I would normally be doing, and then sometimes things jump up and down in life, you know, and you go, hey, there's a bit. But it's almost like it's an external inspiration. Like, I don't – like, it's out there. I always think of it as like when you're chosen to be the captain in high school gym and you get to pick the team for the basketball that day. And there's, you know, kids jumping and pick me. That's what bits are like to me. Things happen in the world and they go, pick me, I'm kind of funny. And you go, ah, I guess that is funny. And then once you have it, then once you have the idea, then you can apply a craft to it. And, all right, let me pick interesting words to make this pop a little bit more. But the original inspiration, I don't know how to do that.
is but I think there's something about the machine of being so regular with your touring that your brain is just kind of greased up all the time because it's fairly, you know, even though you take a few months off here and there, I think the machine isn't rusty. So I think that is probably always working in your favor.
Yes and no. I mean, I definitely have my lull periods where I don't feel like I'm being there. I'm not thinking of much, you know what I mean? And then I don't know what it is. I guess maybe it's similar to an author who has a writer's block or something like that. It doesn't go for a long period of time, but I'll go through periods of time. I don't worry about them anymore because I've gone through them in the past and I know I'm going to turn a corner somewhere and boom, all of a sudden I'm going to start thinking about some things that are interesting to me, you know? So I just wait for it to get fertile again.
Well, that's really important that you have that confidence because it is, you can go through those periods where you're like, oh yeah, I guess there was a finite amount of comedy water in my barrel and it's empty now and it's never going to rain again. This is the drought that's going to kill, you know. And then a month will go by. I'm like, oh, okay, wait. Oh, right. Okay, maybe I'm not a complete moron.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as long as you have those moments where it's like, ah, boom, your brain starts percolating again. Those are fun times to go through.
Have you ever had the moment where you see comedians that you loved and then they kind of get older and then they do stand up again and you're like, yeah, I don't know, you know, and not really the same. You know, I have this conversation with people with other comics about, like, is it that they get rich and comfortable and they're maybe isolated so they're not noticing the same things that everyone notices? Or is it, you know, is comedy like a hungry man's game where they kind of have to always get a little hunger, and if they're not hungry in some way, then they just don't really care anymore?
Well, I think there's the of the people aspect to comedy, you know, where it's like you need to be an example of the people that you're talking to. And if you're living a life that's different from them, it's hard to make them laugh, you know. You know, you need to be able to go to the grocery store and you need to be able to take a cab. And when you're not doing those things, you know, you're left with a much smaller window of
art collecting is weird. Well, I don't know why this stuff isn't killing.
That's exactly right. What is the deal with chauffeurs?
They're not supposed to talk to you when you get into the car, but they
get in a bag of a car. And I'm trying to go to a highfalutin restaurant.
I'm clearly from the Old West because I said highfalutin.
Highfalutin. And they turn around and they want to bend my ear. I'm like, come on, folks, you with me on this?
I think upscale Brian Regan would be a fun chunk of just like, you know, I'd like to pretend, like basically you just pretend that, you know, you're a billionaire and you've lived like a billionaire, but you still have the same cadence, but it's just all of that stuff.
Well, I have this whole thing about what's the deal with first class people, and it comes from the perspective of, you know, people in coach. And I got off stage one time and my tour manager was joking with me going, people aren't buying it anymore, Brian. They know you're not in coach.
I know. I think Louis.
You know,
I think,
what I mean. So it's.
I think Louis said on Conan or something one time. He was like, he started out kind of apologetically, like, yeah, you know, sometimes I fly. You know what? Fuck it. I fly first class. All right. I make a lot of money. I don't have to fly coach. Why would I? So I think, you know. But again, that's just as long as you're honest with the audience. I think they're okay.
Well,
I think
yeah,
they're okay with it.
You want it to ring true, and you can't be doing things that people are like, I don't know about that. You know.
I always wondered if. You know, there are purists out there who are like, no, I can't live too well. If I live too well, it kind of takes me out of the game, and I got to make sure that I'm still forcing myself. But I even think that's not totally authentic because that's not really what you're experiencing. You know, right. You're kind of forcing that experience to happen.
I'd rather give up comedy and fly first class.
It's really worth it. Really can be worth it. So when is when the new tour, the new special is?
Saturday, September 26th. It's live on Comedy Central, 9 p.m.
Excellent. And what's the title?
I don't know. I think it's Brian Regan, live from Radio City Music Hall.
Okay.
There's no like really clever title.
Just so people know, because sometimes Comedy Central will air like a bunch of they could air a bunch of Brian Regan stuff just to make sure that people know it's.
Yeah, I mean they are showing some of my past specials in the week or two leading up to it, which I guess we're in that window now. But it's just Brian Regan live from Radio City Music Hall.
Yeah. And if it's a special where, you know, you're wearing a shirt that does not look of this era, it's probably an older special. <That's> Why is he wearing shoulder pads in the year 2015?
Hey, that's something that I also picked up from George Carlin. He was smart enough to not, in his earlier years, you know, he's wearing bell bottoms in a special or whatever. And then he started wearing all black. And I always wondered, like, if he did it so that the comedy could be timeless. And so I did a special a long time ago, and I told my manager, I do not want to wear anything that is currently hip. I want to wear just classic jeans and shoes. You know, I want it to be where you could watch it 10 years from now and not immediately get sucked into the haircut or the clothes. You know, I want it to be about the comedy.
Cut to you dressed like a 1930s gangster. Like, I just... I didn't say
I thought it was classic.
I mean, it was timeless. I thought it was timeless. Apparently, it's not timeless in the movie.
Yeah.
Are you on social media at all?
I have a Twitter account, and I've made over like 12 tweets in my career, my Twitter. I have that stuff. I participate, you know, reluctantly.
Yeah. Do you think it's bad for comedy for people to see too much? Okay.
No. I mean, I just it's just not my vehicle, I guess, you know. I mean I know that's how you get things out there, and I'll shoot a tweet every now and then, or, you know, update the Facebook page or whatever, but I just like to be on stage. That's what I want to do.
And ultimately, if you just were able to do that the rest of your life, would that's what would make you happy?
It would be wonderful. That doesn't mean I wouldn't love for someone to give me an opportunity to do a TV show where it could be about my comedy, you know, as long as they kind of, you know, don't get in the way.
That's very hard for television. Television is notorious for getting in the way. You must have done pilots before and stuff.
No, I've gotten close, you know, to certain things, sometimes a hair short of doing a pilot. You know, what's interesting to me is, like, you pitch an idea to a network, right? And then they say, well, we don't have any shows like that. I thought that was a good thing.
Right?
I thought you were going to go, oh, fantastic, and, you know, throw confetti around. But I didn't realize, well, that's a bad thing for them.
Yeah.
We want shows that are like the shows we already have. Well, you already have shows like the shows you already have. I want to do something completely different.
Yeah, but I just didn't feel like throwing confetti. So I'm sorry, we can't make the show.
Right.
And we're supposed to throw the confetti if we're going to make the show, so it's not, like, anyway. But thank you for coming in. It's like, why the fuck? Well, the reasons that things don't get picked up, or I mean, I've talked to network people who are like, I was so excited to get on the other side of it, to really try to understand this mysterious process of how shows get made. It must be like an Illuminati type experience. It must be like picking a pope, you know? And then they get there and they're like, it is mundane, and the dumbest reasons, things happen for the dumbest reasons, and you don't know, and it, whatever mood people are in that day. And it was so disheartening that it kind of like ruins television for them.
I always, I equate it to, if you put a blank white canvas up, right? And then you could bring Van Gogh back from the dead, and you put him in front of the white blank canvas, and then right on the other side, behind Van Gogh, put a set of bleachers with network executives. What would end up on that canvas? And I don't think it would be Van Gogh's vision. You know, he would put one thing and they go, well, why so blurry?
Does it have to be blue?
Yeah, there's plenty of blue already. Put some greens or reds.
And there could be a daytime thing? Could you make a daytime
thing? Yeah, daytime. People like daytime.
Yeah. That ear thing is weird. Do you think that's going to test well? Oh, Jesus Christ.
So I would love to see a network / Van Gogh production.
Also, the network would be completely nonplussed that you brought someone back from the dead. Yeah, that's great.
But how are we going to capitalize on this?
Does it have to be a canvas? Yes. Brian Regan, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to
you. Thank you so much.
Such an honor. And Joe Bolster, so nice to see you and meet you in person, too. It's a teller. The first time I ever heard him talk, it flipped me out.
Yeah.
Because I still, as much as I know how entertainment works, I still feel stupid at certain times when things that I feel like I should have known, I'm like, oh, fuck, you do talk, you know, like I just...
I was on a flight with him about a week ago, I swear. Teller, like, sat like two seats in front of me. And when the flight attendant came and said, what do you want? And he said out loud his drink. I was like, whoa! All it took, I'll have a water. Whoa, man! You don't hear that a lot.
I almost feel like that is a long con where it's like you never talk, so then whenever you do open your mouth, whatever it is, people think it's the greatest thing they've ever heard. Like, that is a genius. That's
yeah,
a genius
plan. Pretty darn cool.
Good to see you, Brian Regan.
Thank you very, very much, man. I appreciate the kind words.
Oh,
thank
please.
You very much for having me in here, and it means the world to me.
I'm super geeking out about the... I mean, honestly, I don't know if I did a good job of, like, mashing it down, but it is a tremendous deal for that you're here.
That's very
on
kind.
The podcast. So, are you playing in L.A. anytime soon?
I had shows in California Wednesday through Sunday. The last 2 days, I've just been doing media, so not soon.
All right. Well, I'll watch the special.
All right.
Or, you know, we could set up a stage right here. Here and you could just
can I do the fucking the fucking Pop-Tart joke?
Please,
all right.
Please just do that on a loop. All right,
you're gonna bleep it though.
Enjoy it.
We have already agreed.
I don't know.
We've already agreed that
no,
everything gets bleeped.
I don't know if we actually agreed to that, but let's just let me ask you a question. Do you ever listen to any of the stuff that you do,
like this kind
yeah,
of stuff?
Yeah, will you listen to this?
Yes,
fuck.
Yes, because I try to. You're gonna bleep that, right?
What you
just said?
No,
you
I
gotta bleep
it.
That
no,
out.
You said it you
because
said
I'm on.
It.
No,
you opened
no.
The floodgate.
Wait a second.
You opened the fuck gates.
Fuck you.
Oh boy.
All right. Perfect.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies and brands to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.